What I'm going to try and do is not only speak about training, but how we maximize our investment in training. Because I think at the end of the day, we want impact of our training. From my perspective, we have much to be happy about in terms of the achievements that we have done in the last 10, 15 years. But our job is not done. And clearly, there are many, many countries that are still not on track to achieve MDGs 4 and 5. But we are about to set some new targets. And I think we are about to set some unprecedented targets, targets that we have in the past not even been able to reach. But we are about to set those targets. And I think it's a good thing that we do set these kinds of targets, because it's a shame that a woman should die during childbirth. No woman should die during childbirth. No child should die. So our targets are going to be about ending preventable maternal and child deaths. From my perspective, to be able to do that and set unprecedented targets, we also need unprecedented commitments. We need new partnerships, and I really want to focus on, in my talk, about these creative partnerships. In some ways, I often think about, we often get together in meetings of like minds, but what it's going to take is bring people of unlike minds to focus on a problem. And I think we need to think about that. Clearly, innovation is important, but it's not just technology innovation that we need. It is systems innovation. It is program innovation that I think is needed as well. And lastly, I think we need to talk about scale. And really, we should not be making any excuses about scale. My definition of scale is achieving universal coverage at scale. My definition of scale is getting quality at scale. And my definition of scale is about getting impact at scale. I think anybody who has got a lesser definition is not going to get us to those unprecedented targets. We have a significant level of scientific understanding already in terms of the interventions that we want to do. We know what things we have to do, but we don't necessarily do that in patient care. So there's this implementation gap. Margaret Chan said it best, that our systems just do not seem to have the ability to implement what we already know sufficiently. So I think for me, there are two components of how we are going to bridge this implementation gap. One is certainly by training, but the other one that I want to focus on a little bit more is clinical governance, ensuring that people put into practice the things they have been trained for. So let me just take this example out of India. This is a fairly new registry, which was just started by a professional organization in India, and they just got many hospitals to submit by SMS some key information about eclampsia. And over a period of time, they collected information about preeclampsia from almost 100,000 pregnancies. That's larger amount of information than they've ever had in terms of any information about preeclampsia. But more important, they were able to identify some gaps in implementation. So for example, only 44% of the cases of eclampsia received magnesium sulfate, which is sort of the drug of choice, which is cheap, inexpensive, and really effective. Many people were using other drugs which are actually more expensive, less effective, and actually more dangerous for the baby and the mother. So here we go, some information that we've known actually since the turn of the last century, right? So this is information we know from almost 100 years, and yet this is not necessarily reaching the level of implementation that is out there. The second part of the response from these 100,000 was that it took 32% of people more than 4 hours to start this therapy. Now, eclampsia is a very serious condition. If you don't get your treatment very quickly within the first hour or so after the convulsions occur, then you get mortality. The sooner you get this therapy in, the better it is. 4 hours is just not a good standard. Doing it in half an hour from the time of convulsion is probably a better standard. So we, a majority of patients in this well-served nation, are not getting the treatment in a timely manner, as a result of which people are getting recurrent convulsions even while they're in the facility, right? So all of these things lead to now preeclampsia becoming one of the leading causes. Now, none of these interventions really require a training approach. If you think about it, they require knowledge and implementation. There's no training required to do that. Most of them just require that knowledge. Here's data from 6 other countries from MCHIP, which was a USAID-supported flagship program. related to preeclampsia. And you see the statistics are fairly poor. To be able to detect preeclampsia, you've got to do both the blood pressure and the protein test. Very few women were having their protein tests done. Very few women had repeated blood pressure taken during the course of labor. Very few people had even the questions asked about signs and symptoms of preeclampsia. So here are some things fairly simple to do, but we've not been able to do them. So from my perspective, this needs a slightly different approach from training. And this is an example of an approach that we used in Nepal. So we basically gave a small sum of money to Nepal professional associations to go out and do a one-day visit to hospitals. In that one day, they updated everybody on the standards of care. They went ahead and filled any training gaps they already had in terms of their knowledge, in terms of their capacity, and in terms of their skills. And then they went ahead and did an assessment of the institution in terms of where the gaps were in terms of their practice. And they decided on some actions to take. They left them there and used cell phones to call them every 2-3 months to figure out what changes they had made. So a training approach and a clinical governance and a performance improvement approach all rolled in one. There was a fairly rapid increase in the proportion of hospitals that were now practicing to standard. All right? So I think for me, using this combined approach, a blended approach of training as well as governance, actually has a better chance of making impact than just a training approach. Now, we have a major challenge, the number of midwives that are available. It's actually very interesting. There are a few countries which have more midwives than the World Health Organization prescribes. The World Health Organization thinks that we ought to have 6 midwives for every 1,000 births. In some countries, we actually have more midwives. That doesn't mean that we are getting better care. So it's not only about the numbers of midwives, it's about the skills of our frontline workers. And the biggest challenge from my perspective is actually that either they are not skilled or they're not practicing the skills that they know how to do. So how do we address that particular gap? For me, one of the biggest investments that we ought to do is to fix our midwifery schools and our nursing schools and our schools for frontline health workers. Chapaigo was very fortunate to be in Afghanistan for many, many years since we were first able to go out there. And at that time, the midwifery schools had been wiped out completely. And well-meaning donors came in, and very soon we had 23 different curricula for nursing education and midwifery education. And after some time, we had to bring everybody together to focus on one way of doing things. I think we succeeded in Afghanistan to create a better midwifery workforce. And I think Afghanistan can be really proud of the midwives they are producing now from their midwifery schools, because the training in that midwifery schools was focused on what nurses needed to do. Their practicum was not in big city urban hospitals. Their practicum was in home births, including births at facilities, because that's how it was going to be practiced. We knew right from the beginning that many of the student midwives, 19-year-olds, 20-year-olds, already had children. So we had to make arrangements in every midwifery school to make sure that there was a nursery and a nanny to look after those children. We recognized that the access to knowledge was through internet. So we had to teach them English as well as computer studies as part of midwifery education. And I think as a package, all of these things were not just about training a midwife. It was about empowering her with knowledge and abilities. And here's an example of a midwife who I met in Afghanistan. She's 19 years old. She heard about a client who had apparently was bleeding. So she went to her house, talked to the husband and said, look, I'm a midwife. I can help your wife. And the man said, no. She is bleeding and I don't think you can help her. You don't have any tools. What can you do? So she went away and came back again after an hour, pleaded with the guy to allow her to take care of woman. He refused again, and 2 or 3 hours later she came back. And this time he allowed her in. And what the woman was having was a retained placenta, something fairly dangerous. And she was bleeding, literally bleeding to death. Now, she went ahead and did a manual removal of placenta right there and then. Now, this is a procedure that midwives and physicians are actually afraid to do, even in the best of settings. But she went ahead and did because she was empowered enough to stand up to this guy. And she was also empowered by the knowledge and the competency and the capability and the proficiency that she had during the course of her training. To me, that's important. You cannot She cannot do these things unless she was super confident. Our midwifery schools must end up with proficient and capable midwives. We don't want a long internship after that to become proficient. They need to become proficient while they're in midwifery school. To me, this girl, this very young girl, actually shows that it's possible. And she's saving lots of lives out there. So we have a similar challenge in India. We have the need to skill up vast numbers of midwives that are needed for India's massive population. And we use the quality improvement approach to improve the capacity of the midwifery schools to train their midwives. The Indian government is desperately trying to get hundreds of thousands of midwives skilled up. And I don't think our traditional ways are actually going to achieve it. So we are testing a new method, a virtual classroom method. So Geeta talked about those modules that we have created. We have advanced those modules not only to impart knowledge and decision making, but also skills type of training. So here's what we do. We have two sites in Bihar where instructors will present the training. We bring them together to these sites and they will do the training virtually. To almost 12 schools, these training programs are very interactive. So there's knowledge being imparted, there's decision-making case studies that are run, and then there are demonstrations that are done, and then facilitators in the classroom. Now, why is this important for us? Well, I think it's important from two perspectives. First of all, every student in those 12 schools are getting a standardized education at the highest possible level. The second part of this is that the teachers in those classrooms are having time now not to spend on didactic training, but have more time to focus on clinical training, getting those clinical skills trained, because they don't have to worry about all of the classroom training that's being done centrally. It's efficient. We've just finished evaluation of this and been asked to scale this up to almost 500 A&M schools in India. The results are very good. At the end of each session, we do knowledge assessments. They're very, very promising. And students actually like this particular way of learning. By and large, it's a better way to scale up this kind of training. One of the things that we try to do is figure out how these health workers work as a team. Classrooms are not the best places where everybody in a team might be. So we use clinical settings to do drills in which the entire member of the team learn how to respond to an emergency. These are simulations, but they are taught when there is downtime. We suddenly run a very quick drill, and each of these individuals has a particular role that they are expected to play. That starts reducing the emergency response time. I think this works very well. People love it. And then they do them on their own. This is our program in Indonesia, the EMAS program supported by USAID. And what they are doing is making data visible. There are standards in that particular institution, and we are working in almost about 70 plus medical institutions, where every aspect of their work is monitored using electronic devices. And they collect this information and put it as a dashboard in the labor ward. So they've decided that they would like to have one midwife for every two patients. If this ratio goes to more than three, that's bad, and that's recorded. So they measure every week what proportion of time there was this not so good a ratio. And that sort of drives some change at the end of the month. And I think using this information and comparing this information between institutions, they're able to start observing changes that they are making. So it's very empowering for people to see, health workers to see the changes occurring. And here's some data. Because everybody's now focused on collecting this information, this is active management of third stage, something that's needed to prevent postpartum hemorrhage. At the beginning of this implementation, about 60% of clients were getting a uterotonic at the end of birth, which is pretty good, but it's not what we want. We want nearly 100%. At that time, 3.2% of people were having postpartum hemorrhage in that environment. So they implemented these standards, and very soon, 90% or more than 90% of people were getting the uterotonic. And they could show that postpartum hemorrhage rates had come down by looking at their own internal data. This is, again, very empowering. It's also very empowering to change the minds of those resistant groups Right? There are many countries where physicians don't allow midwives to provide certain life-saving drugs. But I think this kind of information can be very powerful. So I think for me, converting the knowledge that you have into practice requires this governance mechanism and this measurement mechanism. One of the big challenges in our environment is not only acquiring the skills, but maintaining the skills. Imagine a frontline health worker who doesn't often see a postpartum hemorrhage, but when postpartum hemorrhage occurs, she's got to be ready to do it. If you haven't practiced the skill for a while, then that skill disappears, or your fineness of your ability disappears. But we don't manage and monitor labor very well. So a midwife is supposed to collect all of this information and make sense of 13 or 15 pieces of information to predict problems in labor and to detect problems in labor. It's very complicated. So what we are now doing is creating a handheld device, a tablet device, in which the information can be entered. The machine plots the data. It nags you if you have missed a particular observation. All right, so a nag feature. And it sends out certain alarms and alerts that will tell you if problems are about to occur or are already occurring. And really more important, uses SMS feature to send the same information to a supervisor. So a supervisor on their tablet can see exactly what's happening. So imagine if you're sitting in a district hospital with 5 or 6 health centers where birth is occurring. A senior supervisor, senior nurse, can actually see the labors that are occurring out there, can proactively provide advice and or receive requests for help. To me, there's got several functions here. It's a training function, it is a management function, and it's a governance function. All three rolled up in one. We are about to go and test this out. All of the software has been developed using WHO standards, and it'll be out testing very soon. There's a significant amount of unfinished agenda that we need to address. First, we need to absolutely ensure that midwives who are graduating, and any frontline health worker who is graduating, is fully skilled at the time of graduation. That means we need to fix pre-service education. We can't do band-aid after things have been finished. In-service education needs to be for new things that are coming. We need to focus on respectful care because women will reject poor care and are rejecting poor care. That's a really important thing we have to focus on. There are certain clinical areas that absolutely have been neglected. For example, certainly we have to figure out family planning and prevention of HIV as part of the package of things that midwives need to do. I've already spoken about clinical governance. There is really no point in just training. I think training must be matched with an ability, some sort of governance, some sort of accountability that investment in training is paying off. And more important than all of this is to ensure that the rights of the health workers are also respected. We often talk about rights of patients. I think health workers also have rights. Those rights need to be respected. We know that didactic training has little or no impact. So we need to minimize that kind of training. We know that simulation training is highly effective. We need to maximize that. We know that practice and feedback dosage is important. In other words, you need to do it repeatedly for a long period of time. Put it in small bits, but more frequently. We need to provide feedback, and today with cell phones and everything, virtual feedback is quite possible. We certainly need to help providers practice and learn in the space where they're going to practice. Training them in big city nursing schools and midwifery schools is just not sufficient if we want them to practice in rural areas. So we've got to arrange practicums in that kind of setting.